Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is John Wilsey, an assistant professor of history and Christian apologetics at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, and an instructor in the Darrington Extension of Southwestern Seminary, which is a fully accredited Bachelor's of Science program designed for prison inmates. Dr. Wilsey obtained his Ph.D. degree in theological studies with a concentration in philosophy of religion and a Master's of Divinity from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, as well as a bachelor's degree in history from Furman University. He is the author of two books, including One Nation Under God, An Evangelical Critique of Christian America, and most recently, American Exceptionalism and Civil Religion, Reassessing the History of an Idea. Links to those books and much more available on our website, as always. John, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony, for having me. I appreciate it.
I just noticed this in your biography. You graduated from Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and now you work at Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. In order to basically take care of all four points of the compass, you need to work at South Southern and South Northern Baptist Seminary. But I'm a little curious about where Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary is and where Southeastern is.
The Southeastern Seminary is on the old campus of Wake Forest College in Wake Forest, North Carolina.
Okay, that's east.
And so it's a beautiful, old, historic campus. And then Southwestern is actually located in Fort Worth, and I teach at an extension campus, which is a degree-conferring campus full-time in Houston. So Southeastern's in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Southwestern is in Fort Worth and in Houston, Texas.
Okay, I just have to point out, because you did not major in geography, but Southwest is kind of San Diego, or maybe Hawaii, but, you know, Hawaii's across the ocean there. So we'll say San Diego. You guys got to rename that seminary to South Central.
I'm just going to have to step in and correct you on this very, very gently.
Okay.
I'm being playful, but, you know, the idea is that Fort Worth, Texas, is the gateway to the West. That's what they call themselves. And so since Southwestern Seminary is located at the gateway of the West, they do, in fact, consider themselves the West, even though it's the gateway to the West.
Yeah.
And I know that St. Louis thinks that they're the gateway to the West, too, but people in Texas would not accept that at all.
They do have a big arch.
People in Texas have a very strange view of themselves. It's almost like it's something called Texceptionalism.
Oh, that's your next book. Texceptionalism.
I love it. I can't do it.
let's talk about your new book. I want to congratulate you. It's out from InterVarsity Press. And I want to say something that I normally don't say to very many authors, and that is I really like the cover of your new book.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, now that I should qualify that. That doesn't mean that I dislike the other covers of the books that we've talked about before, but when I opened the package that it came in, the first thing I said is that, ooh, that it's really nice. We'll post a picture of it on our website, and it'll be on the our promotional photo that we have for you, but it's just this classic picture of the Lincoln Memorial backlit at night, and it's got the kind of a font, an older, like 19th century font going on there, and it's gold and black, and it's a sharp thing. Was that cover your idea?
And it's crazy. It wasn't. The cover was not my idea at all. I didn't get any input in the cover at all. But if I had the choice, if I had, you know, had some input, if I could have chosen what the cover would look like, I would have asked for that very scene to be on the cover. And in fact, the original title that I wanted to name the book, I wanted to have in the title, In This Temple, which is the beginning of the phrase, the opening phrase of the words carved into the wall above Lincoln's statue in this temple, you know, describing Lincoln's memory, how he saved the Union and everything. Because when you walk into the Lincoln Memorial, it does have the feel of a Greek temple. It's, you know, you walk in, it's almost like you're walking into the old Acropolis, seeing the statue of Athena high and lifted up on her throne, right? And it's a very civil, religious place, and so, you know, it's just perfect. And it was great because they you know, they didn't ask me what I wanted to have on the cover, but when they looked at the book, you know, that's what spoke to them, and it was beautiful.
So your writing conveys exactly what you want it to the reader, and they picked it there.
They picked it up. It was great. It was a tremendous moment for me.
That is very cool. Did you suggest in this temple, and then the folks at the publisher said, "Nah, we don't want this."
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they said, "Yeah, how about these other choices that you could pick from?"
Okay. I have to admit that my two books, I've had the pleasure of not having to wrestle with that, and I've chosen the covers. In fact, they're both photographs that I've taken. So. Mm. People tell me these horror stories that I wanted to name my book this, but then they changed it to something completely different.
Right.
And they said, either you're going to take this title or not publish your book. And so, but no, it does convey the topic that we're going to cover. I'm sure Lincoln is going to come up quite frequently in this.
Definitely.
Speaking of this book, what motivated you to write a book about American exceptionalism?
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up sort of in the shadow of a military tradition. My grandfather was in was an officer in the Army in World War II, and my grandfather, my dad, so I was in World War II as well, and my father was in the Navy during the Vietnam era, and so I've always been very patriotic, always come from a very patriotic family, and you know, it's a really fascinating idea, just growing up sort of surrounded by you know, patriotic elements in my heritage. And I wrote my dissertation on the idea of America being founded as a Christian nation. And in doing research on my dissertation, American exceptionalism was something that came up quite a bit. And I talk about it a little bit in the dissertation, and I wanted to treat it a lot more. And I just thought, well, I'll just have to write another book. So the American Exceptionalism book is almost a sequel to my dissertation. So you know, when Tom Cruise plays me in the movie, that'll be perfect. Cause the American Exceptionalism book is really just sort of a branching off of my dissertation,
mm-hmm.
I really do sort of see it as a sequel, or sort of as a second word on the topic.
Well, good research always does generate its own sequels. And I know you joked around with the Tom Cruise playing you in the movie thing, but I don't know how many people actually read their book contracts very closely, but both of mine had these clauses, if it becomes a movie, blah, 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 blah. And you got to say.
That's so funny. That was in mine too. I thought, okay, that's cool.
You know, there's a moment in time when you're reading through that and you go, oh, do they really want to make this a movie? I go, no, it's just boilerplate. That's not going to happen. So,
yeah,
but,
right.
So let's talk about American exceptionalism here. So you're dealing with two concepts, actually, American exceptionalism and civil religion, and how the two are intersect. But let's start off with that former one, exceptionalism. And I don't want to dive into the theological undertones of that concept quite yet. So how would you explain American exceptionalism to a layman, somebody that's just kind of coming from abroad and says, what's this American exceptionalism about?
Yeah. It's a huge question. I mean, American exceptionalism is a term that's used a lot, especially now that we're entering into our presidential election season in earnest here in the fall of 2015. It's a term that's used a lot. Marco Rubio, as a Republican candidate, I mean, this is sort of central to his narrative, American exceptionalism. You hear him talk about it all the time. You hear politicians talk about it all the time. You see it appear in the media a lot. And the funny thing is, nobody ever defines the term. Everybody just sort of assumes that we all agree on what that is. And yet, it's very ambiguous. But, you know, how I would describe this to a layperson just in a short way, basically American exceptionalism affirms that America is different than other countries in the world in sort of a comparative way. And then also it is articulated in this way, that America is superior in a normative way, better than other countries. So we're a special, we're a unique people. That can be articulated either as a comparative, in a comparative sense, or in a normative sense. Looking at our founding makes us exceptional. Sidney Martin Lipset, who's a sociologist, wrote a lot on American exceptionalism. He said he called America the first new nation. He also talked about American exceptionalism being a double-edged sword, in that American exceptionalism denotes America as being the worst and the best. The worst at some things and the best at other things. The way he describes exceptionalism is in a comparative way, and he looks at America as an outlier. That's the word that he uses to describe America. Not as a better nation than everybody else or other nations in the world, but as an outlier, as different, as unique, in good ways and in bad ways. But then, you know, it's a very patriotic expression of exceptionalism. We're the greatest, we're the most powerful nation in human history. We're a force for, a force for good, unlike anything the world has ever seen. And America has a moral imperative to remain strong, and America is an indispensable nation, as Madeleine Albright described the United States when she was Secretary of State under Clinton. So these are some of the things that are entailed in it. But just to sum it up, America, American exceptionalism can sort of describe in non-religious terms as either as different or as special, different in comparison to other countries, as an outlier, as Lipset said and others have said, or a patriotic expression, you know, we're the best because we're the first at numerous things, the first written constitution, first federal republic, first new nation, et cetera, and we are the best. This is what makes us the best country in the world.
Yeah, I wanted to bring up that first new nation concept that Lipset talks about, because you look throughout history and, you know, modern times, the last 200 or 300 years, we are the first constitutional democracy. We started off this trend of breaking away from a monarchy and breaking away from colonialism that sets off a domino effect in Latin America and other parts of the world over time. Curious that you said Lipset says that it's for good and bad. What are some of the good things about it? What are some of the bad things about it?
Yeah, so Lipset, in terms of negative things, he does talk about the Americans have a disdain for authority. He says we have a disdain for conforming to the rules laid down by the state. And that, you know, is sort of a source of pride for a lot of Americans, but it leads to, Lipset says, the highest crime rate, as well as the lowest level of voting participation in the developed world. So that's an interesting idea that he touches on. Americans disdain for authority to throw off the British yoke and so forth and start our, you know, and chart our own path. Also leads to a lawlessness that no other developed world experiences, for example. You know, and in terms of good things, you know, Lipset talks about how Americans are, you know, have some of the highest rates of education and college education. Talks about how Americans, despite the fact that they are, they don't have an established church, are some of the most religious people in the world, a uniquely religious nation. So when he talks about, when he wrote his book, American Exceptionalism, A Double-Edged Sword, that double-edged sword notion is what he is pointing to, that these, you know, American exceptionalism entails both positive and negative aspects to it.
Yeah, well, that disdain for authority, I don't know. Some of us think that's kind of a good thing. I don't know. But, you know, we won't go down that rabbit hole. But, yeah, it is kind of interesting that it has both these positive and negative connotations. Now, we're talking here primarily in secular terms, and I think Libset is talking about that as well. To what extent does religion work into this? I mean, a lot of people, your first book is thinking about America as a Christian nation, and a lot of people have talked about that. We've talked to Mark David Hall and John Fea before about these issues on the podcast. How does that play into American exceptionalism?
Yeah, so when I did my research on Christian America, I looked at all of the Christian America literature from 1977 to 2007, which was a trick. And, you know, the assertion that America is a Christian nation is entailed, American exceptionalism is entailed in this assertion that America is a Christian nation. Many of the Christian America writers, particularly Peter Marshall and David Manuel, who write The Light and the Glory, one of the first books in this recent articulation of the Christian America, they believe that America is a new Israel. They believe that America is God's chosen people on earth, and that this is what makes us a Christian nation, is that God specially chose America to be not only a Christian people, but to be his tool in the world to bring the world to, you know, faith in Christ. So when you add Protestant theology to American exceptionalism as a, you know, in sort of a civil religious mix, it's a very potent mix, and it becomes an ideology that is theological, and a theological assertion that people become, you know, wedded to in a way that they would be wedded to a theological doctrine like the virgin birth or the resurrection of Christ. I mean, this is something that's going to be very difficult for people to divorce themselves or to divest themselves of. Once they buy into it.
How has this concept changed over time? Your book takes a pretty large view of American history, and I can imagine that there's some tension between the secular aspects of American exceptionalism and the religious aspects of American exceptionalism. And it varies according to, you know, the different trends in society. Last week we talked with David Mislin about the late 1800s, early 1900s, and changes in the religious landscape there. I could imagine that during that time or other periods of time, there would be some changes in how we see the balance of secular and religious aspects of American exceptionalism.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. The book I talk about, I try to, you know, draw this metaphor of a double-stem maple tree. So the roots of exceptionalism, I trace these roots in Protestant theology, particularly with the Puritans of the 17th and 18th century. I look at exegetical sources of the preaching in the Revolutionary period. I look at historical sources, historiographical sources, particularly in the writings of George Bancroft, and political sources, particularly in Christian republicanism, radical Whig ideology that comes out of the English Civil War and later is going to help animate the American Revolutionary ideas. So exceptionalism comes up out of these many roots. The tree of exceptionalism comes out of these many roots. But by the time you get to the 19th century, and when you have westward expansion and you have slavery and you have the issues that lead up to the Civil War, exceptionalism as a concept begins to break off and begin to diverge and to have two distinct articulations, two distinct branches of exceptionalism. And one is very religious. It's a religious nationalism, seeing America in terms of God's chosen people, seeing America as having a divine commission, a divine responsibility to fulfill, seeing the land itself as being sacred, seeing the nation as being morally innocent, and seeing it as having a particular glory to it. That's what I call closed American exceptionalism, because it's exclusionary. It divides people up in terms of the chosen and the other. But Lincoln is the first figure to really articulate a non-religious view of exceptionalism where he calls America the last best hope of Earth. He clearly believes that America is a normatively superior country, superior civilization to others in the world. But yet, he thinks that America, what makes America exceptional, what makes America unique, is the Declaration of Independence, and particularly what's expressed in the Declaration of Independence, namely a very clear conception of justice, of right and wrong. Lincoln talks about, you know, right and wrong, being on the side of right all the time in his speeches and writings, and also that all men are created equal. And for Lincoln, he believed very strongly that that was a term that included everybody. It included African Americans, and it included whites. So it included those who were born in slavery and those who were born white and in freedom. And in the 1858 debates with Stephen Douglas, this is one of the issues that he hit Douglas on. Douglas said, well, Thomas Jefferson, he didn't really believe that all men were created equal because he was a slave owner. And Lincoln, you know, shot that down. He said, absolutely, he believed that. And the proof of that was that Jefferson himself feared that God was going to judge America for slavery, saying, you know, I fear for my country, you know, that because I know that God's justice can't sleep forever. You know, so Lincoln calls on those, on those attitudes in Jefferson. Even though he was a slave owner, he still did mean that all men are created equal, referred to African Americans as well. And he wanted America to be seen on the side of right and on the side of God, on God's side, on the issue of slavery. Otherwise, the last best hope of Earth could not be saved. It would have to, you know, it would have to be died this death in the Civil War that was just tearing the country apart at the time. So open exceptionalism, this is what Lincoln is talking about. It's not that there's no appeal to God at all. It's not a totally, you know, non-theistic articulation of exceptionalism, because Lincoln still has a belief in providence that he talks about quite a bit. But it doesn't borrow heavily from Christian theology. You know, these Christian doctrines like election and divine commission and regeneration, these heavily theological themes that are in Christianity, you know, he doesn't borrow those themes like, you know, some earlier figures do, particularly among the Puritans and the revolutionary preachers, and even John L. O'Sullivan, who is a contemporary of Lincoln. Instead, his articulation of exceptionalism is a political construct that calls upon the American ideals, particularly as they're expressed in the Declaration of Independence.
You mentioned Lincoln here, and earlier you mentioned Marco Rubio. What other figures in history have been associated very clearly with enunciating the concept of American exceptionalism?
Yeah, so I talk about several in my book. I look at, for example, John L. O'Sullivan, who I just mentioned a second ago. John L. O'Sullivan, 19th century figure. He's the founding editor of a widely read journal called the United States Magazine and Democratic Review. It's a journal that forcefully advocates for westward expansion. It's O'Sullivan that's credited mainly with coining the term Manifest Destiny in 1845. And he coins that term in the context of the annexation of Texas, which of course happens in December of 1845. O'Sullivan saw American or exceptionalism, Manifest Destiny, and sort of bases that Manifest Destiny on two ideas. One would be providential certainty. So he believes that he can sort of read the providence of God in the signs of the times, in the same way that we would read, you know, a weather forecast. You know, we can have certainty about these things. And he also bases Manifest Destiny on white supremacy. So Latinos, Native Americans, African Americans, these peoples are going to either be assimilated or they're going to be eliminated. And they'll be dominated by Anglo-Americans. Someone else would be Theodore Roosevelt, who, of course, more than any other person, gets us involved in a war with Spain in 1898. He writes about true patriotism. I mentioned him at the beginning of my book. Woodrow Wilson, who saw America in messianic terms. John Foster Dulles, who was Dwight Eisenhower's Secretary of State in the 1950s. The Cold War was really getting started. And then Ronald Reagan. I devote a lot of attention to Ronald Reagan in one of my chapters in the book on moral innocence and moral regeneration. Ronald Reagan saw America in very pure terms. He couldn't conceive of America being responsible for any of the ills of the world, as he said. So, you know, over the course of our history, there have been figures that come along, and some of them articulate exceptionalism in a very closed way. Some more open than others, and then there's a mixture. Nobody really articulates exceptionalism in a pure, closed, or open way. There's always some aspects of closed and open exceptionalism in every articulation, but every articulation will also lean more towards closed or more towards open.
Mm-hmm. It would seem that John O'Sullivan was more on the closed side, almost a pure articulation of it. Would that be a good read?
Definitely. Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. He sees it's got destiny for America to overspread the entire North American continent, possibly all the way down to South America, too, but definitely to dominate Mexico and definitely to even dominate Canada to our north. But even though Sullivan will still articulate American ideals, and there would be things that, despite our recoiling at most of the things that O'Sullivan would say, most Americans would still agree that our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence, our founding ideals, are preferable to a monarchy, preferable to a tyranny, these sorts of things. So, you know, O'Sullivan still will call upon American founding ideals, but, you know, his basis for manifest destiny, providential certainty and Anglo-American superiority and supremacy, certainly, you know, we would quickly reject that.
And that in the background is Rocky J. Barkington, our research on religion mascot, who firmly ensconced himself in the studio today and would not leave. So for those of you interested, he must be barking at. He's a very exceptional dog.
Yes.
So
closed or open.
He's more open. He's a friend to all. He just loves, and especially rabbits. But coming back to American exceptionalism, I want to connect this to the other concept that you have in the title of your book, which is civil religion. Now, we talked a little bit about the aspects of Christianity that is embedded in some of the American exceptionalism, some of the closed exceptionalisms, as well as some of the theological undertones of the open exceptionalism. But that term civil religion, that's something a little bit different than your typical Christian theology. So explain what that is.
Yeah. Civil religion is a slippery concept. And, basically what I say in the book is that it's a set of practices, symbols, and beliefs distinct from traditional religion, yet providing a universal values paradigm around which the citizenry can unite. So that's how I articulate the meaning of civil religion. But civil religion, is sort of a study or a field that's initiated in the 60s by Robert Bellah, who was a sociologist. He wrote an article called Civil Religion in America in 1967. And he traces how religion sort of animates the American way of life in that very important article that he wrote back in the 60s. Others have come along, and many others have written a lot on civil religion. Most recently, Peter Gardella wrote a book-length treatment on civil religion recently. Ray Habersky wrote about civil religion from World War II, 1945 to the present. And then Sidney Martin Lipset, of course, he writes a couple of books on American exceptionalism. But one of the things, you know, so civil religion can either be articulated in a salvific way, like a traditional religion, like Christianity, and it can also be articulated as a more of a political and a social construct. And, you know, when it comes to sources, civil religion in America draws from at least three: Protestant Christian theology, Enlightenment philosophy, and Roman civil religion. So from Protestant Christian theology comes the idea of monotheism, you know, America's God, national salvation through divine chosenness, God-ordained mission. From Enlightenment philosophy and political philosophy, notions of individual freedom, natural rights, equality, liberalism with a lowercase l, common sense realism of the Scottish Enlightenment, and then from Roman civilization, the whole idea of the patria, the fatherland, the homeland, loyalty to the homeland, loyalty to our country and our state in a sort of a patriotic, a self-sacrificing patriotic way. So these three sources sort of get mixed together and form a civil religion for Americans. More recently, scholars have looked at civil religion and the concept and sort of come to the conclusion that, you know, there really isn't one civil religion that can be nailed down and sort of defined, but civil religion is such a malleable concept and such a slippery concept that there are often many civil religions. That civil religion is sort of guided along and defined by groups. So Arthur Remillard wrote a book called Southern Civil Religions. And, you know, in that book, he looks at African Americans, for one, as a community that has a very distinct civil religion. I talk about this in my book some as well, that this idea of chosenness for America and white supremacy also has a articulation in African American civil religion, particularly through black nationalism and through the use of the Bible during the period before abolition. Exodus, you know, the book of Exodus in the Bible is called upon by many African Americans to talk about how God is going to deliver them from slavery, to draw them out of the bondage of Egypt and across the Red Sea and into the promised land of freedom. So civil religion is a unified concept. It's not like it's a hard and fast, you know, sharply defined faith system. It certainly, you know, is a construct, a social construct. It shouldn't have salvific ramifications, although sometimes it does, with America being the savior of the world. When civil religion is animated more by borrowing from Christian theology, it's at its worst. But when civil religion is more of a political construct that is animated by American founding ideals that are founded in the, you know, Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, even the Gettysburg Address, or Lincoln's second inaugural, I would say that civil religion is at its best because it serves as a unifying set of ideas for Americans to gather around.
So that latter, you would say, would be more of a open American exceptionalism.
Yeah, I would. Yeah. I would. And civil religion is sort of a larger category that mm-hmm. American exceptionalism is an aspect of.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this concept, because your book is subtitled Reassessing the History of an Idea, and America goes through a lot of different changes, some of them very turbulent, like the Civil War, other times maybe not so turbulent, but you know, history is always filled with conflict and such. A couple of the chapters that you deal with in your book deal with the Western expansion. And there is this great drawing in the book of this angelic figure hovering over the, I guess, the people from the Oregon Trail, or the, you know, they're in the wagon train, and
right.
the behind the angels, all this light. And then as the wagon train moves forward, there's this darkness, and the angelic figure is pushing back the darkness. And so tell us how the concept of American exceptionalism played out in this period of time, and whether it was a debated concept at that time at all.
Oh yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that I find so helpful about Raymond Bursky's work on civil religion is, and I think he's absolutely right about this, is that civil religion is really only understood or best understood in the context of wars. It's through wars and through conflict that American exceptionalism and civil religion are most clearly defined, most discussed, most talked about. And this painting that you're referring to that I have in my book, it's a painting entitled American Progress, and the painter's name is John Gass. He did it in 1872, and it depicts the darkness of the West receding before the approach of American civilization. So on the, but behind this angelic figure that represents America and progress and American civilization, you see her, she's drawing along a telegraph wire in her hands. She has a tablet in her, she's holding a tablet in her right arm, which is, indicative of the written word and civilization. There are railroads in the, behind her. There's commerce going on behind her. All is light. There's farms, people farming and plowing their fields behind her. And then in front, you have, these Native Americans who are cowering in front of her, and they're retreating at her approach. And it's there's wild animals in the darkness, and they're retreating before her approach. And so this is the spread of American progress, the manifest destiny, the idea that God has ordained America to civilize the continent, and then manifest destiny is extended after 1898. To mean that America is going to civilize not just the North American continent, but also the darkened territories of the Spanish Empire, like the Philippines and Cuba and Puerto Rico, territories like that beyond our shores. Like talking about this before has been debated. Certainly, manifest destiny was a popular idea in the 19th century, but it wasn't universally agreed upon. The American Whigs, the Northern Whigs, the Whig Party, represented by Northern interests, they, for example, were opposed to the Mexican War in 1846 through 48. They didn't want America to get involved in expanding into, at the time was Northern Mexico, because they didn't want to see slavery extended into those territories. And the reason they didn't want to see slavery extended into those territories was because it would give the South more power in the Congress, in the House, and the Senate, and in the Supreme Court, and the presidency. So that's one of the reasons why. There's also moral reasons and so forth. But it's manifest destiny is not a an idea that all Americans accept. It's certainly debated in the Spanish-American War in 1898. Not everybody wants America to have an empire. And of course, Americans at the time, people like Theodore Roosevelt said, well, it's not really an empire. We're not imperialistic. We're not, like the British or the French or the Russians or something like that. We're a benevolent, democratic people, and we're extending our ideals and our civilization to awaken people who have been oppressed and to free people who have been oppressed in other parts of the world. But of course, a lot of people a lot of people don't agree with that. So in the 19th century, westward expansion, slavery, these are critical issues that American exceptionalism is sort of entailed in and wrapped up in. Imperialism in the early part of the late 19th century, early part of the 20th. Then World War I, Woodrow Wilson seeing America as the savior of the world. Europe has been plunged into this terrible, destructive war, and America is going to come in and end the war and set the world and set civilization on a more Christian path. And America would be the key to the salvation of the world. So as American history unfolds and as America is involved in other conflicts in the world, American exceptionalism, civil religion, they are defined along the contours of whatever the immediate context is going to be.
Now, you mentioned that very clearly, and I think that's a really interesting point, that civil religion and American exceptionalism becomes more clearly defined, if not also contested, during periods of war. And you mentioned World War I, the Spanish-American War, U.S.-Mexican War. But there's a big war that looms in American history where I can see that this concept of American exceptionalism really comes to the fore and really becomes contested, and that's the U.S. Civil War. How does the whole concept of American exceptionalism play out there. Again, you devote a lot of time talking about Lincoln and his thoughts and this era. And then also, interestingly, how other people view Lincoln as well. So talk a little bit about the Civil War era, American exceptionalism, and the echoes from that.
Yeah, so there's a, you know, there's an interesting episode in 1862. Lincoln hosts a group of clergymen at the White House in 1862, and they're having a conversation, and one of the clergymen expressed their belief that God was on their side. God was on the side of the Union. And this was something that was said, you know, almost off the cuff. It's something that, well, everybody would assume that God is on our side. God is against, you know, the South and the forces of rebellion and secession and the slave interests and all that. And Lincoln sort of stunned this group of clergymen by saying, I disagree with you. He said, I know that the Lord is always on the side of right, but it is my constant anxiety and prayer that I and the nation should be on the Lord's side. And that's, you know, it's a really unique way to think about your country in the middle of a war that threatens your existence.
Mm-hmm.
Both sides, of course, the South and the North, thought that God was on their side. Both sides thought they were the true expression of a holy and Christian nation. But Lincoln's view of providence, for example, being very different from most people. Most people thought that God's providence was something that you could read in the signs of the times. But Lincoln said that, you know, his conviction was that you can't know God's providence. The ways of the Lord are mysterious. And in 1862, that same year, Lincoln, you know, wrote down some meditations on God's providence, and he didn't tell anybody about it. This little document was found in his papers after he was dead. But he was grappling personally with the ramifications of the war and God's providence. He said that God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time. In the present civil war, it is quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party. So that's something he's ruminating in 1862, and then in 1865, when he gives his second inaugural, you know, he says, the Almighty has his own purposes, and if God wills that, you know, the war continue, so it still must be said that judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. You know, he comes to believe that God is judging the whole country for slavery, and God is punishing the entire country for slavery. And the war might continue on. It might go on indefinitely. But however long it's going to go on is going to be up to God. But we don't know what God's purposes are, ultimately. So that whole concept of providence that he had, it's really fascinating. I mean, most people today, might be uncomfortable thinking about providence in history. I know that, you know, as a historian, you know, we back off from talking about providence in history and all this. But Lincoln had a high view of providence. He just thought that providence was something you can't ever know. And in applying that to America as the last best hope of earth, I mean, his prayer is that, you know, America would recover and be faithful to its founding ideals that are expressed in the Declaration of Independence. Because those ideals are what really make America unique, what really make America great, that America is a just country as expressed in the documents, as expressed in the founding. And we need not depart from those founding ideals that are animated by a strong sense of right and wrong, a strong sense of justice, a strong sense of human dignity. So this is what I love about Lincoln, about Lincoln's concept of patriotism. It's not borrowing so heavily from religious doctrines. It is a political and a social construct, and it's not contradictory to the Christian faith. And I as an evangelical Christian, I really resonate with that. I don't want to see American civil religion displacing my own faith system. And Lincoln's does not. Lincoln's does not at all.
Lincoln is probably one of the most providential characters in American history, coming to the fore at a very unique and difficult time in American history, wrestling with America's original sin, so to speak, of slavery. And,
right.
You know, he's that character, too, that after the war ends, his purpose seems done, and then he's taken away through assassination. Just reading that story every time, it just puts chills up your spine, and you do a very nice job of addressing that in the book. The other thing that you do, and I thought this was really fascinating, is that you look at Lincoln's view of American exceptionalism and his concept of civil religion through the eyes of others, and in particular, after slavery has been abolished, we still have issues of civil rights. We're still wrestling with that original sin. And you talk about W.E.B. Du Bois. Is it Du Bois or Du Bois?
Du Bois.
Du Bois. Yeah, I've heard people pronounce it differently, and I kind of go the French route, but Du Bois. Explain how you viewed that, because I thought that was just an absolutely stellar part of the book.
Thank you. I see Du Bois. Du Bois is just a fascinating character. I liken him to Aristotle, because he is so ample in his writings. He is so original in his thinking. He is, you can spend your entire life reading and thinking about Du Bois. Du Bois is truly a fascinating figure. And Du Bois, in 1922, he was the he was instrumental, of course, in founding the NAACP, and he wrote in The Crisis, which was the journal of the NAACP in 1922, about Lincoln. He said that Lincoln was of illegitimate birth, poorly educated, and unusually ugly, awkward, and ill-dressed. But he was a man of inconsistencies also. He said, both despising Negroes and letting them fight and vote, protecting slavery and freeing slaves. He wrote that in 1922. Many of his readers, were sort of taken aback by this, because his African-American audience at the time, of course, saw Lincoln as the great emancipator. How could you speak amiss of Abraham Lincoln? And so he wrote of Lincoln. He said, I love him, not because he was perfect, but because he was not, and yet triumphed. And what he said about Lincoln is, I think, applicable to open American exceptionalism. And Du Bois is an example of someone who saw the potential in America through the lens of the ideals that America was founded on, like Lincoln did. And like Lincoln, Du Bois calls Americans to faithfulness to those ideals, especially in his early writing career. So, for example, in The Souls of Black Folk that he writes in 1903, he talks about how America is unfaithful to those founding ideals and the consequences that unfaithfulness has to a huge percentage of the population, to African Americans in the United States. And that's a strange thing, because he says that America would not be possible. America would not exist without African Americans. The African-American contribution to America is indispensable to the formation of the nation. So in Souls of Black Folk, he says, your country, how came it yours? Before the pilgrims landed, we were here. Here we have brought our three gifts and mingled them with yours, gift of story, of song, soft, stirring melody in an ill-harmonized and unmelodious land. He goes on to talk about how African-Americans cleared the land, how they built civilization on their backs and on their shoulders. He says the gift of sweat and brawn to beat back the wilderness. He says our song, our toil, our cheer and warning have been given to this nation in blood brotherhood. Are not these gifts worth the giving? Is not this work and striving? Would America have been America without her Negro people? And he says, of course, no. And then he writes another book called The Gift of Black Folk, where he writes about the, you know, he spends a book-length treatment talking about the African-American contribution to American civilization. And, you know, what's great about reading Du Bois is he spends so much time thinking about and talking about human dignity, how human dignity is something denied to African Americans in his life. It's denied to African Americans. Their humanity is denied. And that, he says, is a great betrayal of the founding of America. And these are things that appear mainly in his early writings and his maybe early middle writings. I think they're very helpful to contribute to the idea of exceptionalism, that, you know, an open exceptionalism, which can be really helpful for us in our patriotism and in our civic engagement, is this notion that America is not perfect. America is guilty of many, many flaws. And if we live in denial and bury those flaws and not look them in the face and not deal with them, we're going to always live with their consequences, and they're going to tear us apart eventually. And I think we're seeing this. I think we're seeing a lot of that in our nation in the issue of race. Americans have traditionally been very reticent, very much not willing to face up to the consequences of the original sin, slavery, and then Jim Crow and racial prejudice. And these things keep cropping up because we haven't ever really dealt with those issues head on, like someone like Du Bois would have said we needed to. But in open exceptionalism, we love our country, but we don't deny the sins of the country. We acknowledge them, we look them in the face, and we deal with them in a realistic way.
Yeah, I think the quote that you provided by Du Bois and his, you know, examination of how he viewed America's exceptionalism as well as Lincoln really sums up that open exceptionalism, which is, I mean, it resonates with a lot of Christian theology in that you know, we strive for good and to be perfect, but we always acknowledge that we are the sinners, that, you know, we are tainted by original sin, but yet we still triumph. I was just that quote in the book was just fantastic. So,
yeah, thank you. Yeah. So, and that notion of self-examination, that dates all the way back to the Puritans and to the Jeremiads that they preached and wrote about in their literature, calling their people to repent of their national sins. And this is something that Barack Obama talks about in a lot of his references to exceptionalism. Self-examination is always a part of the president's conception of exceptionalism. You see it all the time.
That you do. Well, let me finish up with some reflections here. And just two last questions. You brought up President Obama. You brought up some of the difficulties that we're facing with race relations today. Where do you think American exceptionalism is heading, say, in the near future here? And then also, what have you taken away from your study of all of this? I mean, I always love to ask historians to reflect upon the lessons that they learn, because, you know, doing scholarship is not just reporting something to somebody else, but it can be very transformative of the scholar, him or herself. So I toss those two questions out there for you.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, the future of Americans, I mean, so I can always fall back on the, you know, I'm a historian, I can't predict the future.
Yeah, but we don't let historians do that on the show. So,
well, I mean, you can just kind of look and see at some contemporary things that are going on. I think a lot of people are beginning to reject the strongly religious forms of exceptionalism, the closed exceptionalism that I talked about. I think a lot of people, especially a lot of millennials, younger people, are rejecting this notion that America is America can do anything it sets its mind to, and that there's a moral imperative of America being militarily unassailable. I hope to see a shift away from closed exceptionalism that's based on strongly religious themes, and a turn more to a more realistic approach to the country. You can certainly still embrace exceptionalism. I wouldn't want to see the concept of exceptionalism go away or be completely repudiated. America is an exceptional country. We are the first country. We are the first new nation. We are the first country to be founded on these very liberal and very expansive and generous ideas concerning human dignity. That's, I think, historically sustainable and philosophically sustainable as well. The problem is that we're not always faithful to those ideals. But the great thing is, it's never too late. It's never too late for us to return to those ideals, not just in the world, not just in terms of foreign policy, but certainly in terms of domestic policy as well, in dealing with, you know, tidying up our own house, as it were, with regard to race and with regard to inequalities, you know, that we have in this country, but also with regard to religious freedom and freedom of speech and other basic freedoms that we enjoy and that we cherish. In writing this book and on American exceptionalism and writing my dissertation on Christian America, I think that the huge takeaway that I walk away with is, I mean, just personally, I grew up in the South. I'm a Southerner. I grew up in Georgia. My great-great-great-grandfather was a brigadier general in the Confederate Army, served under Longstreet at Fredericksburg. His brother, my great-great-great-uncle, was a Confederate senator. You know, these people owned slaves. They owned, you know, many scores of slaves on their property in North Georgia, around Athens. And you know, studies that I've done on Christian America and American exceptionalism have awakened me to my own privilege as a white person. And the notion of American exceptionalism is so tied and so inextricably linked to racism and slavery and Jim Crow, and you know, as it's been historically articulated up to now. It's very sobering to me personally. It's sobering to me as a Christian. And I want to study people like Du Bois, study people like someone like Cornel West, study someone like Ida B. Wells, and their views on Americanism, their views on the country. Someone like Frederick Douglass, who writes, what to the Negro is your 4th of July. These are very interesting perspectives to me. They are personally convicting to me. The African-American voice in its contribution to American civilization is fascinating to me. And so I want to look further and study deeper into that. My next book project is hopefully going to be a book on Du Bois and Americanism and his views on America as an idea and as an ideal, and how his views on Americanism evolve in his writings. I think that personally as a Christian, Christians have a very special responsibility to help contribute to racial peace in this country. And I hope to see that hopefully if the book makes any impact at all, I hope that it awakens Christians' eyes in the country to Christians' special responsibility as Christians and as Americans to help be an edifying voice in these issues that really are tearing us apart.
Well, that is a very noble goal, and one that I hope that you do accomplish. You make great strides in it with your book, American Exceptionalism and Civil Religion, and we'll be looking forward to that next book. My guest today has been John Wilsey. John, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.